The Vermont Conversation with David Goodman, exploring ideas with innovators, change makers, business leaders, politicians, and activists. A special feature from Vermont Business for Social Responsibility, underwritten in part by CW Print and Design, formerly Copy World, your local digital print shop, offering quick design and printing services for projects of all sizes. By Green Mountain Power, partnering with customers on energy transformation while delivering clean, reliable, and cost-effective power. The Alchemist, serving the greater Wataveri community and Vermont since 2003. UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, the heart and science of medicine. By Concept 2, designers and manufacturers of Concept 2 rowing oars, indoor rower, and ski erg. Proud to support nonprofit groups such as Local Motion, Vermont's statewide nonprofit advocate for walkable and bikeable communities. Let's Grow Kids, focusing on the first years of child development, as well as over 750 VBSR business members who believe that sustainable business practices value people, planet, and profit. Learn more at www.vbsr.org.
Welcome to this week's Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. Today on the Vermont Conversation, we'll spend our first half hour with the author of a new children's book about Pete Seeger. And in our second half hour, we'll be talking about veto session politics with advocates for marijuana legalization and representatives from the teachers' union, getting some perspective on what happened last week in the State House. But first, we're joined by Lita Schubert. She is the author of the new children's book, Listen, How Pete Seeger Got America Singing. It includes beautiful pictures by Raoul Colon. Lita Schubert is the author of 10 books, including Monsieur Marceau, Ballet of the Elephants, and The Princess of Borscht. She was a core faculty member at Vermont College of Fine Arts in writing for children and young adults, and she lives in Plainfield with her husband and two dogs. Lita, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you, David. Thanks for having me.
What inspired you to write a book about Pete Seeger?
Pete did. Let's see, the long answer. I guess I always knew that Pete would die because it seems that there's a bad plan out there and that everybody dies. And he had a good long life, but I really hoped he would live forever. And one day I turned on NPR and I heard those distinctive banjo tones, and I knew that the only reason I'd be hearing them is because Pete had died. And I just started to cry, and I couldn't stop. And I cried and cried and listened all day and put on some of my collection of Pete and honored him by playing his music. And I'm a writer, and I found that the way that I could process that terrible grief and sense of loss was by writing about him. And so I didn't really plan on doing it. I had friends who were writing about him, and I didn't want to step on their toes, but I had to do it. I had to do a little tribute to him. He had been my hero my whole life, since I was a tiny little girl.
What was it that you admired about him?
Pretty much everything. His music, his politics, his way of being on the planet, his stance for the environment, his singing, his way of using music as a vehicle to change the world. And his life, he was a good person. When I turned in the manuscript, my editor, Neil Porter, said, "You sound like you're writing about a saint." And I said, "I'm sorry." He was.
You met Pete Seeger once.
Once.
Tell us about that.
Well, he was picking up garbage at the Champlain Valley Folk Festival. I don't remember what year this was, but it was probably 12 years ago or so. If Mark Sustick is out there, call in with the date. And I finally just got up the nerve to go up to him. And I knew that probably over his lifetime, 20,000 people had done this. I don't know how many. And I just couldn't help it. And I knew that it would embarrass him because he was a very shy person, but I had to. And so I went up to him and I said, "Pete, I just want to thank you for all you've done and the music that you've given us all your life and how much joy and pleasure it's brought to me and everybody else." And he just sort of looked at the sky, and his wife Toshi was with him, and she took my hand and she said, "He really does appreciate it." And of course, I started to cry again, but I knew that as a person who is now somewhat, has been on the receiving end of people thanking me for things, so on a very, 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 very small scale, it's something that is a mixture of emotions. Like, I appreciate it very much, and you can't hear it too often, but on the other hand, it's embarrassing. So I know how he must have felt on a very, 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 very tiny level.
All right, well, let's turn to your book. And since Lita did put out the challenge of people who have a Pete Seeger memory, you're welcome to share that by calling us at 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. You evoked a Pete Seeger memory that I have right in the beginning of your book, which begins, and this is a children's book, "There was nobody like Pete Seeger. Wherever he went, he got people singing. With his head thrown back and his Adam's apple bouncing, picking his long-necked banjo or strumming his 12-string guitar, Pete sang old songs with new words, and songs he made up. In front of crowds large and small, he'd raise his arm. Basses, here's your part, he'd say. Tenors, sopranos, altos, here's yours." Here's where I'll cut away. And yes, I remember well going to a Pete Seeger concert in Sanders Theater in Cambridge, Mass. And this was a packed theater. And he was conducting as if he was conducting the Boston Symphony.
Yeah.
And had everybody singing. That concert actually got turned into one of his many, many albums.
Mm-hmm.
How did he do that?
I don't know. He had a charisma and a belief some way of encouraging people to sing that I think has never been replicated. He could just raise his arm and people would start singing. What? How did he do that? And he says something about that, if I can find it. He said, "I just tap out a beat, pick a few chords, and say, 'Come on, you folks know this old tune.' Pretty soon the audience will be singing the song to me," he said. Well, it can't have been that simple, but it did work that way. And even when he couldn't sing, when he lost his voice in the last years of his life, he would just raise his arm and people would start singing. I saw him in Lebanon, New Hampshire, shortly before he got ill and died, and same thing happened.
You know, you include, this is a children's book, but you include a lot of things in here for adults. First is the story of Pete, which is compelling in and of itself, but there's also a timeline. And I think it's useful to just kind of remind people who may not know some of the highlights of Pete Seeger's life. And I'm looking at your timeline. In the 1930s, he attends Harvard University. In the 1940s, he forms the Weavers. And then in the 1950s, he is hauled up before the House Committee on Un-American Activities for alleged communist activities and then cited for contempt of Congress for having refused to answer the questions of the committee based on his First Amendment rights. I'll just skip through a few more things. He helped found the Newport Folk Festival. In the 1990s, he receives a Grammy Award for Lifetime Achievement, the National Medal of Arts. He's inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, named a living legend by the Library of Congress. And then, and I did see this too, sings "This Land Is Your Land" with Bruce Springsteen and his grandson, Tal Rodriguez Seeger, at Barack Obama's inaugural concert. Joins Occupy Wall Street protests at age 92 in 2011, and in 2014 dies at the age of 94. Wow.
A long life. A long, good life. Yeah.
Let's go back to that issue of being hauled in front of Senator Joe McCarthy's notorious House Un-American Activities Committee. This was devastating to many artists.
Absolutely.
Of that era.
Yes.
What did it do to Pete Seeger?
Well, we're mostly familiar with the Hollywood 10, but there were many, many, many people throughout the country who lost their jobs and whose lives were never the same. And what it did to Pete was it deprived him of the venues that he had been singing in, and the Weavers fell apart. And he was not able to sing in Carnegie Hall and television. He was blacklisted from television for many years. So he made his living singing in camps and high schools and colleges. And to me, the interesting thing about that is that by doing so, he created a whole cadre of young people who knew his songs and followed him and fell in love with his music. And I'm not sure that would have happened otherwise. And when those young people came of age in the 60s, he had a sort of guaranteed movement that he had built over the years. And I think he was at least in large part responsible for the youth movement of the 60s through those songs.
Now, when we say he couldn't perform at places like Carnegie Hall, there was no rules here, right? It was that Carnegie Hall didn't want to voluntarily abided by the blacklist that was created by Joseph McCarthy.
There was so much fear in the country. There were people who were afraid to hire anybody who was blacklisted for fear of losing their own reputation, their own followers, their own funding. And it was pretty universal. It was a sickness in the country.
Now, this touches a personal chord with you and your family. Tell us about that.
My father was fired in 1955 from his job at the National Bureau of Standards. He was investigated. My mother was too, but my mother wasn't a government worker. I don't think they were members of the Communist Party. They said they weren't, and there's no evidence that they were. But this McCarthyism spread throughout Washington, where we lived, southeast Washington, D.C., and many people were affected, and we moved out of Washington, and my father became a college professor. He taught at American University for the rest of his life. So we were among the lucky ones. Mm-hmm. We had a source of income, and we did all right. But it was a terrible time, and of course there are many people who are fearful that we are facing another McCarthyism now.
And what do you think, you having lived through one McCarthy era?
I'm very afraid, and I think people should be very afraid, and I think there's enough out there that we should be worried about, and we should be very, very watchful of our rights and of our, we should be acting with the kind of courage that Pete showed all throughout his life. We should be standing up, and we should be absolutely sure that our First Amendment rights are not taken away from us. You know, when Pete took the First, it was unusual. Most people were taking the Fifth, which was the right against self-incrimination. But he said, I'm taking the First. I'm demanding my rights of free speech. And it's important that we all do that, and that we demonstrate, and that we make sure that our rights are not taken away.
Now, when he appeared before the McCarthy hearings, he wanted to play his banjo.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
What happened there?
He kept singing. The words he said are available online, and it would be really interesting for people to read the transcript in its entirety, because it's terrifying. It's just terrifying. And what Pete said was, I love my country very deeply. He offered to sing a song, and that song was, our fathers bled at Valley Forge. The snow was red with blood. Their faith was warm. Their faith cried out for brotherhood. Wasn't that a time? And they said, no, you can't sing that song here. This is the hallowed halls of Congress. And so he sang it out on the street. And he said, you know, this is my right. And he was indicted for contempt of Congress. And he fought that for many years. It was about 7 years before his indictment was overturned.
Hmm. You go on, and throughout your book, you mention many of the songs that he is known for.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these songs, like the best sort of children's literature, have meaning both for adults and children. So you have Michael, Row Your Boat Ashore, Guantanamera, Turn, Turn, Turn. Tell us a song that you feel has that kind of wonderful double meaning for...
A double meaning.
Yeah.
For both adults and children. That's tough. A double meaning.
Well, for example, when he sang about the Hudson River, he had a love affair with the Hudson River, which was really a toxic waste ground for a long time. So talk about his relationship to the river.
Well, he and his wife, Toshi, built a log cabin overlooking the river. And, you know, he sort of woke up and said, this river's been poisoned. And if I could read that little part, can I read that little part? That mighty river had been poisoned. Factories had dumped chemical waste in it for years. So once again, Pete went to work. People laughed. You can't do that all by yourself, they said. And he couldn't. But when he sailed the great sloop Clearwater, they all came to see it. Guess what? They left caring about that river, and then they went to work, too. It wasn't long before people could swim there. If anybody asks you where in the world is the most important place, tell them right where you are, Pete said. So for me, that does have, I guess, that double meaning, that, first of all, we can all make a difference. Everybody can make a difference. And I guess if there's one thing I would want kids to take away from this book, it's that they can make a difference. But you can make a difference with other people. And that's what Pete did. He didn't stop and say, well, I can't change the river all by myself. He saw this sloop and he said, hey, we can copy that. We'll raise the money. We'll build this ship. We'll sail it up and down the river. We'll clean up the river. It's an astonishing thing to try to do. And he did it. And, you know, as Trump reverses environmental laws, who knows what's going to happen? One by one, he's cutting down all the laws that keep that river clean. It kills me. And, you know, if Pete were still alive, it would be killing him. So I think we have to get out there and make a lot of those ships and sail those ships up and down the river and sail them up and down the Lake Champlain. Because where we live is the most important place. And go ahead.
Well, we're talking on the Vermont Conversation today with Lita Schubert. She is the author of a new book about Pete Seeger. But she is an award-winning author of many children's books. And Lita, I want to touch on some of those. First of all, what has led you to want to write for children?
I spent pretty much my whole life connecting children in books. That's really what I did. We were talking right before we started about Cambridge, life in Cambridge. I went to the Harvard Ed School, and when I moved up to Vermont, I ran a preschool. And in Plainfield, where I've lived ever since. And for me, that was all about connecting little kids, wonderful little kids who mostly still live in Plainfield, with the opportunity to read to them and to hope that books can change lives. And then I became a teacher in public schools, and then I became a school librarian, and then I worked for the State Department of Education as the school library consultant, working with school librarians all over the state. And then I decided to do what I had always wanted to do, which was write children's books. And so that's my mission, is to use books to change the world, even though my books, I would never think that my books would do that. But books as a whole can. And so that's what I really wanted to do. And I'm a reader and have always read. And I think that books are powerful. So that's what I wanted to do. I think I'm becoming completely inarticulate.
What brought you to Vermont? You talked about growing up in D.C. What brought you to Vermont?
D.C. was a terrible place to live in the summers. It's a swamp, and there was polio. There was a polio epidemic. And my parents also worked both very hard all summer long, and they sent me off to this camp, a summer camp. We had no money. We were quite poor. But they sent me off to this camp, which was in Connecticut. And the camp had an outpost, they called it, in Vermont on Nichols Pond. And we would come up in the summers and clear land and climb Mount Mansfield and climb Camel's Hump in the screwiest ways. I mean, we would set out on these camping trips with just a sleeping bag and a pack on our backs, and nobody ever knew what the weather was going to be, and it was madness. And so Vermont always had the happy place, was the happy place in my heart and my mind. And as soon as I finished school, I moved up here.
The things that you have written about, you wrote a book about Marcel Marceau, mm-hmm. which won the Orbis Pictus Award for mm-hmm. Outstanding Nonfiction. How do you choose your subjects? Why did you write a book about this world-famous pantomime artist?
Well, usually the subjects find me. Usually it's a matter of waking up one day and or dreaming about something, or, you know, just something comes to me, or I'll be reading the newspaper and I'll see an obituary, or I'll find a little tidbit of news that just calls to my heart. But that particular one, my agent wrote to me the day after Marceau died, and he said, hey, are you interested in writing about Marcel Marceau? And I said, no. And then I started reading the obituaries. I knew nothing about him. I didn't know he was Jewish. I didn't know he was active in the Holocaust. I didn't know he led children to freedom at tremendous risk. And so I became fascinated by him. And wrote his story. And it's interesting, you asked about the HUAC part and of Pete's life, and how do you write about the Holocaust in a book for young children? So I found that quite a challenge, and I figured if I could do that, I could write about HUAC.
So, just quickly, some of your other books. The Ballet of the Elephants is a nonfiction picture mm-hmm. book. What's it about?
It is about a ballet for 50 elephants that was choreographed by George Balanchine to music by Igor Stravinsky for the Barnum and Bailey Ringling Brothers Circus in 1942 with the prima ballerina Modoc the Elephant and the other prima ballerina Vera Zorinsky, who was married to Zorinsky, was that her name? Honestly, I'm losing my mind, to Balanchine at the time. And it was a huge premiere, and it played all over the country. And now that there are no more elephants in circuses and no more circuses at all, I hope that the book helps people remember that once these things happened in a moment of time that was really full of amazing events.
Well, we know that Circus Smirkus is just beginning its summer tour.
The wonderful, glorious Circus Smirkus.
Let's not sell them short. And talk about The Princess of Borscht, another one of your books.
That was kind of an homage to my grandmother who made borscht. And I only found out recently that my father was also a fan of borscht, of a recipe for borscht. And it's a story about some little old ladies in an apartment building who fight over the right recipe for borscht, while a little girl makes it to save her grandmother from what she feels is a certain death in a hospital.
My grandmother also made borscht, and I'm a huge fan of borscht.
Really? Yes.
So you've also worked with some remarkable artists, mm-hmm. Mary Azarian, mm-hmm. the Vermont artist, your current book about Pete Seeger, Raoul Cologne. Talk about how you work with artists. It's a very... seems to be a very sort of intimate interplay between words and art.
You would think, but in the wonderful world of picture books, unless you are very famous, which I certainly am not, I basically don't see the book until it's done. My editor chooses the artist, whoever that editor is, chooses the artist. I do sometimes get the okay. In other words, I'll get a note from my editor saying, what do you think about this? And I've had the right of refusal, but I've never used it. I felt extremely lucky to get Raoul Cologne, who's a fabulous artist, and I've never felt unlucky. I've really been a lucky person with all of my artists, starting with Mary, and then sometimes you don't even see the book until it's done. Sometimes they send art along the way, but it's a really unusual process, because were I able to see the book in process, I would be able to change some of the words and say, like, well, we don't need that because it's in the illustration. But that you don't get that opportunity most of the time.
How do you do your research, say, about Pete Seeger?
I was a history major. Research is my life. I love doing research. If anybody wants me to research anything, send me an email. I'll find out anything. You know, I use hidden databases, I use books, I go to eBay, I find old pictures, I'm just an obsessive researcher. The question is, how do I stop doing research? And then, of course, the question for a book is, how do you forget all the research and just write the story?
Last question, what do you want kids to take away from reading your book about Pete Seeger?
I would hope several things. First of all, I would hope they would all turn off their cell phones, get a guitar or a banjo and sing with friends and learn the songs and sing with their parents or get their parents to take that long forgotten banjo or guitar out of their closet and sing with them. And second of all, I would hope that they would think about projects and things that they can do to change the world and make it all a better place for all of us. So those two things.
All right. Well, Lita Schubert, I want to thank you for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you, David. Thanks so much.
Lita Schubert is the author of the new children's book called Listen, How Pete Seeger Got America Singing. We'll be back just after the news to talk about veto session politics here in Vermont. Stay tuned.